Hello everyone, nice to see you. Okay, this talk is called What Enlightenment Is Not. So, shortly after I began training at the House of Inner Tranquility in the mid-1980s, I requested a meditation interview with one of my teachers, Alan James. I'd been practicing for several months and wanted to report back to Alan and get some much-needed guidance. For the most part, the interview focused on Vipassana practice, but towards the end of the conversation, I had a chance to ask some general questions. At that time, there'd been a great deal of attention in the popular media given to the mysterious appearance of crop circles in cornfields in the Wiltshire countryside. Indeed, my wife Susan and I had been out the previous weekend traipsing across the hills in the Devizes area and marvelling at the crop circles that we encountered, some of which were impressively intricate. What could be causing these intriguing phenomena? Could they possibly be man-made, which seemed implausible to us? Was it something to do with mini-tornado air vortices, a natural meteorological occurrence, as some have suggested, or was it the result of extraterrestrial intelligences trying to communicate important messages to a human race in crisis? How could these circles be explained? Well, here was my chance to ask an enlightened teacher. Surely, if anyone could offer some insight into the mystery, then it would be Alan. So I posed the question, to him and rehearsed a few of the theories. My words hung in the air for a while, and then Alan gave me a rather quizzical, and I might say stern, look. "Why on earth do you think I would know the answer to that question?" he replied. I've absolutely no idea." And that was the rather abrupt conclusion to my meditation interview. So Alan's answer certainly gave me pause for thought. On further reflection, I realised that I'd made some unwarranted assumptions about what enlightenment wisdom is. My question to Alan was premised on the assumption that an enlightened person would be omniscient, that they would be all-knowing and have answers for everything. The experience led me to conclude, rightly, that this is simply not the case. Enlightenment certainly is not omniscience. Neither does it magically bestow any particular skills. The cessation of all ignorance, craving, and hatred doesn't suddenly bring with it an ability, for instance, to play virtuoso violin, to speak Mandarin fluently, or to understand the mathematics of quantum physics. Neither does it give you psychic powers, nor an ability to reach the deepest states of concentration. And, as I discovered, it doesn't enable you to explain the appearance of crop circles. Enlightenment wisdom is far, far subtler and transcends any form of worldly knowledge and attainment. Alan's response to my naive question taught me a really important lesson, that I had to jettison the wrong view I'd held about enlightenment and omniscience. So I've called this talk What Enlightenment Is Not for a reason. When we start training in Vipassana meditation, we hear that the path leads to the complete release from all forms of attachment, ignorance, craving, and delusion. In short, it leads to total freedom, liberation from suffering, nibbana. But as beginners, we have only the vaguest idea of what that liberation might entail. So quite naturally, we speculate about it based on our preconceptions and pre-existing conditioning. For example, I came to the training as a young man studying for a university doctorate. Although I had faith that a training in mindfulness meditation practice was the way forward, I thought implicitly that coming to enlightenment must, by necessity, involve acquiring book knowledge. I simply couldn't help myself in making these assumptions. Progress, I incorrectly thought, would entail reading as much as I could about Buddhism and meditation. And to aid my studies, I thought perhaps it would also help if I learned the Pali language and maybe Sanskrit too. Now, I'm not for a moment saying that acquiring a working knowledge of the most important aspects of the Dhamma, learning about the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and so forth, is unimportant. It is important, but mine was an unhealthy obsession with book learning based on my academic conditioning. It took me very many years to root out this problem through meditation practice. And it also needed the compassionate help of my teachers, who persistently and patiently kept pointing me in the right direction. Only with time did I properly realize that book knowledge is in no way the same thing as experiential understanding. So to be absolutely clear, one does not have to be clever or knowledgeable in academic terms to make progress on the path. It's a matter of keeping things simple and having the faith to put into practice, to the very best of our abilities, the instructions were given by our teachers. If we do this, we cannot help but succeed. Practicing mindfulness meditation is a simple affair, but getting to that simplicity takes a great deal of determination, dedication, and repetitive application. The Buddha did sometimes describe Nibbana in affirmative terms as the highest happiness and supreme bliss, for example. But more often than not, he framed enlightenment wisdom in the negative. It's described, for instance, as the ending of suffering, a blowing out of the candle, cessation, extinction, the laying down of a burden, the absence of attachments, and so on. This is because, in general, it's more accurate to understand Nibbana as an absence, the removal of the veil of ignorance, than as something that is acquired. Nibbana is revealed when one has removed all the obstacles that obscure clear seeing. It is definitely not an attribute or skill that can be acquired or possessed. When the mind is fully prepared, and not before, Nibbana appears like the sun from behind a cloud. This is a particularly difficult notion for Westerners to grasp, as we're so used to the idea of progressing by acquiring this or that possession, obtaining this or that qualification, getting this or that job or promotion, or acquiring new skills and abilities. Following the Eightfold Path to Enlightenment, by contrast, involves learning through experience to discard wrong views about the way the world is, and to come gradually to a clear and direct apprehension of reality, unadulterated by any view, right or wrong. And indeed, as Alan James once put it so elegantly, meditation itself is the art of learning what not to do. Wrong views about Nibbana come in various shapes and sizes. Listening to a football commentator on Match of the Day recently, I heard that Brighton and Hove Albion fans would all be in Nirvana now that their team had reached the semi-finals of the FA Cup. Well, they might have experienced a few moments of excitement and elation, which incidentally gives the lie to one of the ways that people seek release through entertainment. But clearly, it's not the permanent ending of all suffering promised if we follow the Eightfold Path to its ultimate destination. As Alan and Jackie James describe in their book, A Meditation Retreat, wrong views and speculations about enlightenment belong broadly to one or other of two theories, the Golden Palace theory and the Puff of Blue Smoke theory. According to the Golden Palace theory, the end of suffering is conceived as reaching the best of all possible worlds, one in which all one's desires are satisfied and one can luxuriate, metaphorically speaking, in pleasurable, palatial circumstances. By contrast, the Puff of Blue Smoke theory imagines enlightenment to involve complete and literal extinction, In other words, the enlightened person disappears in a puff of blue smoke, thereby being liberated from all suffering. Incidentally, each of these views is related to different character types. Someone with a strong craving root will be disposed to view nibbana as the acquisition of all things pleasurable, whereas someone with a strong hate root imagines it to be the elimination of everything, including themselves. Neither group of views is correct. There is no golden palace to inhabit, and nibbana does not entail disappearing off the face of the planet. If it did result in literally disappearing, then once he'd realized enlightenment, there would have been no Buddha left to set out the wonderful teaching and leave the legacy that we all benefit from so greatly. The ancient classical commentary on the Pali Canon, known as the Visuddhimagga, the Path of Purification, contains a section that documents all manner of variations on the Golden Palace and Puff of Blue Smoke theories. Some of these are rather quirky. For instance, some monks espouse the view that as soon as someone becomes enlightened, they'd have to enter a monastery within 7 days or perish. The reason given was that because they have abandoned all desire, the enlightened person would be incapable of looking after themselves. Where, for example, would their volition to feed or clothe themselves come from? This wrong view may seem extreme, but it exemplifies a very common set of assumptions. The fundamental error here is a misunderstanding about the ending of craving, and the Pali word for craving is tanha. And it's a misunderstanding of what that term means, what that ending of craving means. To abandon craving is not at all the same thing as abandoning desire. In Pali, there's a word, chanda, which translates as desire to do. It's true that enlightenment does make the mind incapable of craving, hatred, and attachment, but it does not involve giving up on life itself. In other words, desire to do, the basic everyday volitions that enable us to get up in the morning, get dressed, have a wash, make a cup of tea, eat breakfast, and generally go about our daily business, that remains completely intact following awakening. In Buddhism, human experience is often analyzed in terms of the five khandhas, sometimes referred to as the aggregates or five groups of grasping. The five are bodily form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. Taken together, they encompass all the possibilities of human experience. Desire to do, the term I was talking about just now, for instance, falls into the mental formation group. Prior to enlightenment, these aggregates exist as groups of grasping. In other words, we can get attached and cling to any aspect of these groups. We might, for instance, become preoccupied excessively with our bodily or facial appearance, or get caught up in a depressive mood. There are myriad opportunities to find things to crave for and get attached to. After enlightenment, the khandhas still persist. We definitely do not disappear in a puff of blue smoke. But the awakened mind is simply not drawn to attach itself to any of the khandhas. In fact, having uprooted craving, the fundamental cause of suffering, the mind is incapable of attachment. One might desire to look presentable in public, for instance, but there'd be no obsession with or attachment to one's physical appearance. Equally, depression becomes a thing of the past, as moods are fully understood to be fleeting and are simply allowed to arise and pass away without any extra interference or grasping. An enlightened person, conventionally speaking, still experiences both pleasurable and painful feeling, but there is no craving for pleasure to last or aversion towards the pain. Each of the five khandhas are just there as facts of life, but no longer treated as things to be grasped at or clung to. There's no inclination on the part of the liberated mind to get elated or dejected about any experience they give rise to. It remains immovably equanimous as contacts with the six sense bases, that's touch, sight, smell, taste, auditory contacts, and mental contacts, as those things just come and go. One metaphor the Buddha invoked to capture the solidity of this equanimity was to imagine a great pillar, let's say Nelson's Column, buried deep into the earth with only a few feet left exposed. Nothing is going to shift that pillar. And the awakened mind is similarly imperturbable in the face of any sense contact. Confusions over the difference between craving, tanha, and desire to do, chanta, are not limited to ancient historical texts. A friend of mine recently suggested I watch a YouTube video of a dialogue between two self-proclaimed meditation experts. Both speakers claimed openly not only to be highly skilled in Buddhist concentration meditation, but also to have completed the four paths of vipassana. In other words, they both claimed to have realized arahantship. I must say that as I viewed this exchange, I became increasingly doubtful about the claims of at least one of the speakers. It was clear from what was said that, like the monks in the Visuddhimagga example, he was unclear about the experiential meaning of the cessation of craving, hatred, and attachment. He questioned whether it was truly possible to overcome all desire, and openly doubted whether the Buddha himself had achieved this state of being. He gave examples of suttas in the Pali Canon where the Buddha seems to express preferences, likes and dislikes, that are indicative of the presence of desire, and also the way he sometimes, the Buddha that is, gets cross with people, which this particular commentator interpreted as showing that the Buddha was capable of hatred. In my opinion, this person had fallen foul of the puff of blue smoke theory by concluding that true enlightenment must involve the termination or absence of naturally occurring forms of human experience and expression. The Buddha did not overcome desire as such, and neither has anyone else in human history. If the supporting conditions were present for the Buddha to express a like or dislike, he would. Similarly, he'd sometimes get cross with stubborn students and voice his anger. He's recorded as saying things like, "Ah, you foolish man," when a student had got the wrong end of the stick. But these are neither instances of craving nor hatred. Desires to do or express things are completely normal and natural as long as one is incarnate in the human realm. No spiritual path leads to an ending of desires or other naturally occurring experiences that result from existing in the world. The Buddha most certainly did, however, come to realize the ending of all ignorance, hatred, and craving, which, as I've explained, is quite a different matter. The story of this video exchange also illustrates the fact that one should not take the claims of putative experts at face value. Although perhaps well-intentioned, the words and guidance offered in this instance could plant wrong ideas and thereby lead one astray. If in any doubt at all, it's best to check one's understanding with a meditation teacher whom one trusts, Paul being an obvious example in this context. The most deeply held wrong views concern the three misperceptions of reality, referred to in Pali as the vipalasa. These wrong views center on the investment we make in believing, at the most profound emotional level, that worldly things are permanent, that there is the possibility of finding lasting fulfillment in the human realm, and that we exist as independent entities with discrete selves. It is in investigating and reversing these existential assumptions that vipassana meditation comes into its own and proves to be such a powerful tool. Vipassana affords meditators the opportunity systematically to turn attention towards the impermanence of all phenomena, to observe directly that craving for and clinging to fleeting and impermanent experiences causes suffering. Vipassana also reveals, through meditation experience, that all things are interdependent and void of self. In other words, the wrong views associated with the three vipalasa are experientially challenged and tested by repeatedly noting the three marks of conditioned reality, that is, anicca, dukkha, and anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and non-self. Whether in seated meditation or as we practice mindfulness with clear comprehension in everyday life, we should try to note these marks. Paying systematic attention in this way, particularly to the mark of impermanence, will inevitably generate insight and reduce clinging and attachment. The Buddha himself drew on a very basic bodily metaphor to make this point. He said, "When one eats and drinks and chews and savors, there is excrement and urine. That's one's reward. When one remains focused on the arising and passing away of the five groups of grasping, one perceives the unattractiveness of clinging. That's one's reward." What a training in mindfulness meditation provides is the opportunity to bring the mind in line with the way the world really is, at an ultimate level. In effect, Vipassana is a vehicle that enables meditators to move ever closer to awakening. By traversing the four paths of Vipassana, the meditator gradually perfects an experiential model of enlightenment. The entire process of traveling the paths is rather like refining gold, a metaphor the Buddha himself used, and by which process, in an important sense, we're able to deduce what enlightenment is not. We begin with the coarsest of views, for example, that enlightenment leads to omniscience, and begin slowly to sift out the impurities. As we move forward, the mesh of the sieve gets finer and finer, and we gain ever subtler insight into things like the hindrances to meditation and how to deal with these impurities. When the mesh gets finer still, the three marks of conditioned reality, anicca, dukkha, and anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and non-self, come into clearer focus, and our most deeply held wrong views get challenged. By the time one reaches the end of the fourth path, and experiences arahantship, our experiential model of enlightenment can be said to have been perfected. Someone reaching this stage has fully apprehended, at the most profound experiential level, the meaning of the Four Noble Truths, and knows all there is to be known about the supramundane Eightfold Path. They know for certain what enlightenment is not. But, somewhat ironically, they then find themselves in a kind of limbo, a liminal space that Alan and Jackie James refer to as the gateway to enlightenment. At this stage, nothing more can be done under one's own volition to reach the goal. Yet knowing fully what enlightenment is still remains frustratingly elusive. This is because enlightenment wisdom is knowledge of the unconditioned and therefore cannot be produced by any worldly effort. Sitting at the gateway, as it were, there still remains a slither of ego in place, a subtle, unacknowledged assumption that there is someone to be enlightened. When that subtle element of mind that is still seeking is fully acknowledged, in a nanosecond, the unconditioned is revealed. The last remaining egotistically motivated will to reach something or become something other utterly dissolves, and what is left is unadulterated, pristine perfection, reality as it is. At that point, one knows, in the words of the Visuddhimagga, that there is suffering, but none who suffers. Doing exists, although there is no doer. Nibbana is, but no extinguished person. Although there is a path, there is no traveller. My focus in this talk has been what enlightenment is not, but I thought I might conclude by trying to say a few words about what enlightenment is. The problem from the outset is that words are entirely inadequate tools with which to approach the subject. Enlightenment wisdom, by definition, transcends words and evades accurate description. Like others who've tried, I find myself struggling to find ways of expressing it. Typically, on the few occasions, such as this, when I do speak about it, I end up contradicting myself. One might say, for instance, that enlightenment wisdom is extraordinary, yet at the same time, it's also very ordinary. Something that's there all the time, but veiled by ignorance, and therefore taken for granted. The world of appearance is illusory, yet, in another important sense, it isn't. Enlightenment wisdom is transcendent, but at the same time, it's also immanent. It is self-evident and closer than thought itself, and yet we're blind to it. By juxtaposing contradictions, the intention is not to confuse, but rather to intimate that what we're seeking is beyond the duality that words and concepts inevitably introduce. It resides in between, or more properly, beyond any form of words. In one sense, enlightenment is something that everyone already knows, because it is not separate from that which is always already the case. The Buddha makes this very point in the first sutta of the middle-length sayings, his discourse on the synopsis of fundamentals, and in which we find some curious and intriguing statements. The Buddha points out that the ordinary, uninstructed person, that is the person in the street, as it were, who's never encountered meditation, to quote, recognizes Nibbana as Nibbana. Having recognized Nibbana as Nibbana, he thinks of Nibbana. He thinks of the self in regard to Nibbana. He thinks of the self as Nibbana. He thinks Nibbana is mine. He rejoices in Nibbana. What is the reason for this? I say that it is not thoroughly understood by him. So here's a clear assertion that the ordinary person in the street knows enlightenment, but sees and interprets the experience through the wrong lenses. So the Brighton and Hove Albion supporters, whose team reached the FA Cup final, were, in this limited sense, experiencing Nibbana. It's just that they weren't seeing the experience in a clear way. And besides which, their team was beaten by Manchester United on Saturday, I think it was. In the same sutta, the Buddha goes on to say, the Tathagata, perfected one, fully self-awakened one, intuitively knows Nibbana as Nibbana. Having intuitively known Nibbana as Nibbana, he does not think of Nibbana. He does not think of the self in regard to Nibbana. He does not think of the self as Nibbana. He does not think Nibbana is mine. He does not rejoice in Nibbana. What is the reason for this? It is because he, having known that craving is the root of suffering, knows that from becoming there is birth, and that there is old age, and dying for that being. Consequently, I say that the Tathagata, by the waning of all cravings, by dispassion, by stopping, by abandoning, by completely renouncing, is wholly self-awakened. When I first read this sutta in the early years of my training, I found it very perplexing indeed. It's only now that it truly makes sense. Enlightenment is here and now, closer than consciousness itself. In one sense, what we think of as an enlightened person is no different than the ordinary, uninstructed person. And yet, crucially, they have lifted the veil of ignorance and see and know reality as it is. And although profoundly subtle, there's a billion light years between knowing and not knowing. Enlightenment does not lead to any personal gain whatsoever. Yet it is understood to be precisely what one had set out to look for. It is the end of lifetimes of searching, and with the sudden and unexpected awakening, all one's spiritual and existential questions evaporate in an instant. The truth that one was seeking is simply known. Anyone who makes the necessary effort to follow the path of vipassana with diligence and dedication can prepare the mind for the most extraordinary, but simultaneously ordinary, of revelations. They can come to experience liberation and know finally what enlightenment is. Thank you.